It's Friday, February 1st, 2013, and you're listening to episode 289 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 50 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
This is John.
FearTheCon.com. The Fear the Con site is up and accepting registration, so be sure to get signed up and show up. We'd love to see you guys there. Once again, be doing the convention itself on a Friday and Saturday, May 3rd and May 4th, with the wing night on May 2nd. And the local tourism stuff will be repeating from April 28th through May 2nd. When I say repeating, I mean as in we're doing it again. I don't know why I should literally repeat what we did exactly last year, but nonetheless, we will be doing the tourism again. John, you have a non-confession to make, but go ahead.
I do. Oh, this is a confession.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is.
No,
it's not. All right, then screw you. Start the banter topic. So, my confession is that I rolled up a Shadowrun character last night, and I liked it. I liked every second of it.
Would you like me to sing a song about that?
I was heavily assisted by the game master.
I want to hear you sing.
Didn't really know what I was doing at first, and I was kind of scared. And people told me
what
not
did you
to
create?
Do it, but I did it anyway. I created a decker. Primarily, I created a copywriter for a national news program who is also a decker.
I'm kind of surprised the Game Master is even allowing that, because actually in a lot of the Shadowrun games I've played in, they either write out decking or try to reduce it way down because it creates too much of a sub-game.
Wait a minute. Is that the Matrix hacker people?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not that. I'm a rigger. I'm the van driver.
Okay, yeah, you're a rigger.
Driver.
Okay, yeah, that is completely different. Yes.
Okay, whatever. It's all right. The same to me. I'll figure it out when I get there.
They all look alike.
All humans.
All right.
There is magic in the world just because there almost has to be, but it's taken to like Jedi in the original Star Wars film level of presence. Most people believe they exist. No one has ever really seen one. Most people haven't.
So your game master is also kind of altering the setting a bit, pulling
yes,
the magic aspect down.
Part of the sales pitch to the game was, hey, I like Cyberpunk and I like Shadowrun, but I don't like it when people go full hog on wizards are everywhere, dragons are everywhere, blah de blah de blah.
Right.
You know, metahumans are around. That's okay. None of us are playing a metahuman. Yeah. Really light on the hocus pocus and really heavy on the max headroom,
yeah,
which is why I agreed to play in it.
I have not been able to run a Shadowrun game since Fear the Boot has started. Actually, probably since years before. I mean, it's probably been a good decade since I had a Shadowrun game. And I'm not talking here about one shots. So actually, I haven't even played a one shot, but I mean, like an ongoing campaign.
I have yet to play 5 minutes of the game of Shadowrun. This is the first character I've created, and that is it.
And I've had
that's a step more than I've ever done.
Well, yeah, same here.
And I've had a couple invites for online games or remote play games, which I do very much appreciate, but my schedule's an endless disaster. So trying to find the time for that has not worked out yet. But one of these days, I may still do it. Of course, the holdup has always been that within this group, there are two individuals who are pretty resistant to the idea of Shadowrun, mostly because, at least from what I gather, you guys being big fans of classic cyberpunk.
I hate the genre bending, which is why when my friend said we don't have to genre bend really at all to play this Shadowrun game, I said, okay, I'm in.
And Shadowrun is obviously at its core a genre mashup between cyberpunk and fantasy. I mean, obviously that is the case. But one of the things that I have always come back to when we're talking about Shadowrun is, John, in your case, you had never actually played the game.
That's right.
Now, I am not going to put forth the idea that you have to try something to know you'll dislike it. I don't think that's the case. I think there are tons of things where you can extrapolate out your past experiences and say, I'm probably not going to like this.
Or you have trope preferences that are, in fact, informed by direct experience that you can apply to things other than the last rule system you just used them in.
Right, precisely. And so I think it is fair to say, within a certain context at least, I don't like it, or I will probably like it, even though I have not tried it. But Shadowrun really struck me as one of those things that I really always had a sense that you would like it if you tried it. Even Chad, all of his bagging on Shadowrun, has had to admit that as much as he bashes it, he's played a ton of Shadowrun campaigns he really enjoyed. And the game, I think, has a lot to like about it. And unfortunately, I've had this 4th edition book sitting here just collecting dust, and they're now about to release a 5th edition, which seems a little sudden to me, but I don't know, whatever. I had never been able to do
much. When did this come out? Like 08?
I don't remember exactly. I think it's a little more recent than that, but I honestly don't know. You may very well be right. Yeah, Wayne, crack it open. What's the copyright date in there? Even if it turns out that it came out 10 years ago, I guess it still just feels too sudden for me because of the fact that I've never touched 4th edition and now there's a 5th edition coming out.
No, it's more recent than that. Catalyst hasn't really put this stuff into the workshop and brought it back since
2009.
2009, okay. So, I mean, you're talking about something that's only, what, 3.5-ish years old.
Yep. I made the mistake of thinking it would be in the book, but no, it's on the back cover.
Okay, well, there's some art. So about 3.5 years old. So it does seem a little soon for 5th edition, but once again, it's magnified by the fact that I really haven't done much with 4th. But I always had the sense, John, that it is the sort of game that I thought you would like more than you believed you would like it.
I've never had an aversion to playing a Shadowrun game that basically doesn't have the wizard crap in it. I just never had an opportunity to until now.
See, it's all the other stuff that I hear about this thing that makes me think I wouldn't like it, but I'm willing to try just about anything.
My favorite nugget so far is that data is in, like, flops or flips or something. They have refused to quantify how many gigabytes or terabytes are in your head implants and the hard drives, because if you play this game 5 years after it comes out and they turn around and, you know, you whip open the second edition and, oh my God, you have a 16 megabyte internal skull drive.
Yeah.
That's like 15 supercomputers. No.
Well, so actually, abstract. They did in one of the earlier editions. They did actually say what that unit of data worked out to. I'm glad to hear they removed it, because I was told, talking to the guys from Catalyst, that one of the things they really had in mind with 4th edition was Shadowrun was showing its age. For example, to go into the Matrix, you still had to run a wire from your head to a port that you would find in their equivalent of like an internet cafe or a home connection. And this is really hearkening to dial-up days. Yeah. I mean, how many people now anymore have a wire running from their computer to the wall? Even the recording computer we're using right now, which is a desktop computer, has a little USB thing that connects it wirelessly to the rest of the house. So why is it we have hackers in the game, but they don't have technology that exists in your phone right now?
Yep.
I don't know. I carry on about this for a while. But my point being, though, that I am not surprised to hear that you like Shadowrun more than you thought you would, because I have always had the sense that you would like it. I hope for anyone who's sitting at home, if there is a game that some people in your group have been wanting to run for a while that you've never even tried, you're just being a dickwad about it, maybe this is a great day to unpucker and say, you know what, let's at least give it a fair shake. And if it sucks, it sucks, but let's at least give it a fair try. Unless it's Riffs, in which case I understand.
So is our next campaign Riffs?
Oh, no, not even slightly.
This does tie in pretty well, though, to our next topic, which is we were kicking around the representation of damage within role-playing games. And how this came up was we were talking about the new Fate Core system, and that went down all kinds of rabbit trails I'm not going to chase. But we moved from talking about Fate Core to kind of comparing some of its content and length and whatnot to that of Savage Worlds Explorers Edition, which led right into talking about Shaken. Now, if you've never played Savage Worlds, there is pretty much a mini game, which unfortunately at times overtakes the major game, of trying to keep yourself from being shaken. Because every time somebody so much as looks at you wrong, you end up with the shaken status. And what that means is that you are not actually injured, but you are startled or winded, or you're running for cover or throwing up your arms to try and shield your head. And so you're not acting right now. And then in pursuant rounds, you get to make saves and whatever to try and remove this shaken status.
I know a big portion of our community absolutely loves Savage Worlds, but I have to say, Shaken is the most unfun mechanic of any game I've ever played, because it is not fun to have every attack leave you sitting there watching while you do nothing, or spending all of your bennies just so you can act. It's not fun.
No, it's not at all. I hate it whenever I am playing a character, say in a regular system like D&D, and something happens and I lose the ability to act in one round. It drives me freaking nuts. I mean, to the point of anger when it happens for one round. Can you imagine how I react to this f-ing game where I may spend anywhere from 2 to 10 rounds trying to break Shaken?
Note to self, color spray Pat with NPCs in every future Pathfinder game.
I agree with Pat that one of the most frustrating things in a role-playing game, because of the fact that all you control is that one character, and because of the fact that the action moves, especially depending on the system and how detailed your combat is, it may be moving relatively slowly, that when your turn comes around, your action consists of, I'm going to try to regain my ability to act. Oops, I failed.
Exactly.
See you next round.
I'm going to push it one step further. The most frustrating thing in any game, whether it's role-playing game, video game, card game, whatever, is not being able to do anything.
No,
they're waiting.
I agree with that. But I think the difference is in a video game, you take something like World of Warcraft, if you get stunned or feared or something like that, and yes, I realize there's ways of chaining that and making it out of control, but typically you're talking about the course of a couple seconds.
Yeah.
You're not talking about sitting there for what may be 15 minutes between your actions, and you know your prior action was trying to gain control,
yep,
and your next action will be trying to gain control. And I like Savage Worlds. While I don't advocate the idea of having a universal rule system for every game you play, and I think Savage Worlds got kind of overstated a couple years back in that regard, I do think Savage Worlds is a solid system, and I love using it. But as I was saying, that got us into this discussion about how games handle damage, how you describe the damage that exists on a character. And it seems like, broadly speaking, there are two ways of approaching it. Either you approach it with a sense that damage is a total pool. Hit points is the most obvious example. You also, in games like Shadowrun or World of Darkness or whatever, you have a damage track. That you took this many boxes, you cross off that many boxes, or you reduce a pool by this many points, and eventually when you reach zero or some negative number or whatever, you fall dead. The other possibility is that damage becomes a little more modular. The idea that each wound kind of sits on its own until eventually it is too much for you to act anymore. This is something that Fate kind of implements through the use of the negative aspects, where, and I realize they're kind of changing the terminology around here, so I'll just call them negative aspects for now. But the point being that if you get stabbed, yeah, you might take so many points of actual damage, but then you're going to take an effect of, I got stabbed, which somebody else can play a chip against to say, okay, you're trying to charge me, but since you just got stabbed, you're grasping at that wound and not coming after me. Or maybe penalty to your role.
One of the things I like about the approach that they take, when you actually read through the rule systems, the points you're going against, your stress points, those aren't actually health points like in some other games. Basically, that's how resistant you are to getting hurt. When your stress points come down and you start taking these consequences, right, that means you're actually getting hurt. But they're not actually health points, like you're chipping away health points. And that's their in-game, at least, explanation for why you're not taking penalties until you start getting hit.
And there's been something similar to that that's been posited on and off for years within D&D.
Mutant Masterminds has something kind of similar to that,
too. Hit points aren't actually your hit points. They're more of your story presence that if I knock off 10 hit points and you have 150 left, the moral of the story is not that you can survive getting stabbed 16 or 17 times. The moral of the story is that you are so important to events, or you've gotten so good at this, I'm simply whittling down your ability to survive, which of course brings up the counter question, well, why is it cure light wounds as opposed to restore karmic balance or whatever? And they got around this a little bit in the first take on D20 Star Wars, where they separated, I don't remember the nomenclature they used, but you had a hit point pool, which they said cannot be healed, only comes back over time. This is simply you working off your luck. But then you had a much, much smaller health pool that was typically only about the size, I believe, your constitution. Or maybe it was 10 plus your con bonus or something to that effect. And it never really moved. If it did, it was only in like 1 and 2 point increments. But if you started going to that health pool, that now represented the fact that you were getting shot. So if you have 100 of these fortune points or whatever they were called, and I am shooting you and working those down, that's just me putting blaster shots in the air as you dive around them and sidestep them, and you get clipped in the shoulder but didn't really hurt you until I get to your health. And now I've actually put a hole through your chest, and now we're on a different scale and a different kind of damage.
One thing that I think really has to be brought into the conversation about damage is how long combat's going to last. Because how you implement damage is going to directly impact the length of a combat. Because if it's something like, going back to Mutants and Masterminds as my example, if you take bruises, you have no negative effect yet with it, but you're still essentially taking something, but it's not wheedling you down. You know, it's waiting till you have the big enough hit to go over the amount. Or, you know, other systems like that. Sometimes it just takes so long to defeat something, and it feels like you're spinning your wheels over and over and over again. But on the other hand, something like, say, in Savage Worlds, I've seen a character be one-shotted.
Yeah.
that's the opposite effect of this is going too quickly.
Well, in the old West End Star Wars was much more that way too. It was a quick combat. It was very deadly. And so, you know, it depends on what feel you want, but yeah. If you're getting more to the realism, then yes, that ability to be one-shotted makes a lot of sense, especially when you're dealing with high-power energy weapons and stuff.
Yeah, how you deal with damage is going to directly impact the length of your combat and the entire feel of your game.
Well, I would say it's not just going to be the length of the combat, but also the flow of the combat. Let's go back to D&D as an easy example here. What is the difference between a dragon at 1,000 hit points and a dragon at 1? And the answer is fundamentally nothing. He functions in the exact same way at 1 hit point that he did at 1,000. Now, if you move over to a game like Fate, or you move over to a game like Shadowrun, now things start changing. If I shoot somebody but fail to kill them, well, in the process of taking a couple boxes of health, in the older editions of Shadowrun, I just change all their target numbers. So because of the fact that you're injured, every task you're going to perform gets harder. It looks like, from what I was skimming there in 4th edition, that they've moved away from changing target numbers to changing the number of dice you roll. So now it's the same target number, you have less dice to accomplish it with. But there is an effect to that. If I have 3 people charging me, there may be an advantage to using what combat abilities I have to wing all 3 of them. Whereas in D&D, winging all 3 guys is not going to do a damn thing, because they're still going to reach me next round and they are still going to attack me with their full power. I would be far better served eliminating 1 guy. And you see, I guess, kind of a similar sort of thing in Battletech. It is a great tactic and an important tactic to focus fire, but there does come a point in our local nomenclature, this is what Tex and I always called the AGAD, or the as good as dead mechs, where, yeah, they're technically still operational, they're technically still a unit on the field, but it is so beat to crap, it is a non-issue, and so you can move away from it. But our tactic, and this was our other little bit of nomenclature, is cut down the number of guns coming at you. If you've got 4 mechs coming at you, do what you can to take one out, but there is still some advantage to injuring all of them. If you can hit a few of them in such a way as to start getting critical systems offline, knocking out weapons, cracking the engine shell, whatever, there is now going to be a change in the combat to where 4 weakened mechs might actually be easier to deal with than 3 fully healed and 1 destroyed mech. And that's going to be somewhat situational, but the point is, at least it's an arguable point of strategy within the game.
Well, and with Battletech too, when you hit something, you have the chance to take out like a weapon or something with it.
Oh yeah, every shot has a chance of critical.
Yeah. I mean, you never know when you attack. So there is advantage to potentially spreading a little bit of the fire, because you can take off some of those guys.
Right. Yeah. There's also overkill. I mean, if you say, okay, entire lance, focus LRMs on 1 thing every turn, damage resolves simultaneously. Shots are fired simultaneously, usually. So it's really a big giggle when you watch your AC-20 run into a mech that your buddy's PPC just engine shell cored 2 dice rolls before. Damn it.
I've seen it happen. I mean, cause,
as it happens to everyone who plays Battletech for long enough.
You're supposed to declare a fire in the course of 1 phase and then resolve it the following phase as if it was simultaneous. And so exactly like John described, I have seen it where a whole lance is focusing fire. The first shot is a lucky hit that heads the mech, and the rest of the lance is just dumping their shots into a corpse. And not only is it a corpse, if you're playing a campaign, you're destroying your own salvage. Mm-hmm.
And you're building heat, and you're wasting the economy of your own turns. It's just bad for like 9 million reasons.
So we've talked about damage that's in a raw pool. We've talked about damage that's in a pool but carries a consequence. The third type of damage is one that I really have not seen used too often. It's there a little bit in Fate. In the Homebrew Skies of Glass, it's there very much so. But this is the idea that instead of a declining health, you have an increasing set of wounds. So if I look at somebody and say, how many hit points do they have? Well, the answer is really, they don't. Okay, they are a healthy individual. They're effectively at 0. What happens when I attack you is I am starting to injure you. I shatter one of the bones in your arm, tear a tendon in one of your legs, you know, maybe all the way up to something really bad like I put one between your eyes. But you start adding these wounds on, and wounds may have some kind of statistical effect, such as, okay, now you're taking penalties to attributes or penalties to rolls or penalties to certain types of actions, until you either accrue enough wounds or the right kind of wound such that your character is now facing death. And this is the approach that I took when playing with Skies of Glass, because the way that I looked at it is you're in a survival environment. So knowing that you took 5 hit points is really not as important to the game as knowing you took 3 flesh wounds and each one has a potential of becoming infected or something to that effect. Yeah. The other thing that I looked at was the fact that if you think about it, what it takes to kill an 85-year-old lady and what it takes to kill a strapping young person in their 20s, a perfectly fit, you know, Olympic body there, is really the same thing. What's difficult is doing that damage. If I was to stop the heart of the Olympian, she is going to drop dead, just the same as the 85-year-old woman is. The difference is one of them is more prone to physical injury because of brittle bones and lower muscle mass and all these other things than the younger person is. And so the difficulties in getting there.
I like that approach quite a bit, too, because it kind of gives you the feeling of you really are beating down the enemies more than just the numbers. And when you tell someone, okay, your arm is dangling, that means more than saying you've lost 5 hit points.
Right. Yeah, I like modular damage way more in every capacity. It's much more tactically interesting.
Well, and I want to be able to come from behind. So I want to be able to, in the course of the fight, you see that you're hurt really bad, but have that chance of, I just pulled off a lucky shot with my gun.
Yeah.
Everything was going against me, but I somehow managed to pull that off. And I get that feeling more when you're doing it with a penalty than I do with I'm down to a couple hit points.
I will speak briefly in defense of the health pool without penalty in one regard. And I'm generally not a huge fan of, but I will speak in its favor in this regard. In some games, either combat is meant to be so ubiquitous or health is so easily replaced that to track those kinds of wounds or to track some kind of penalty would really be damaging to the balance or flow of the game. For example, let's keep going back to D&D just because it's obviously a well-known game. If you look at Pathfinder or 3035, whatever, you come in to a certain encounter level. It is presupposed that with the resources of a party, you can take a certain number of encounters at varying levels in a certain adventuring period before you have a chance to go back and heal up and rememorize your spells and resupply your arrows and all that kind of stuff. But imagine how that math would change if you came into each combat weaker than the one before. And not just weaker in terms of resources spent, but weaker in terms of my plus 10 to hit is now a plus 4 to hit. And instead of moving 20 feet around, I can move 15 because of the fact that somebody injured one of my legs. Obviously, the whole game math changes here because the enemies you're coming up against are not suffering those penalties. They are, well, depending on the encounter, I suppose, but they are in all probability coming into this completely fresh, whereas you just keep getting worn down and worn down and worn down, so it changes the entire flow of the game.
Yeah, I don't want to play a D&D game that has, you know, that aspect of right. weaker every time, because mm-hmm. that's not the feel of that game to me.
Star Trek is the same way. Star Trek is pretty blunt in terms of damage because there are, generally speaking, two states, which is there and vaporized. But assuming something occurred where you took the plot injury, your hit points don't affect anything. And in Star Trek, that makes sense because medical technology is so easily applied. I mean, they can just wave a little whistling device over you, and it's going to seal up the wound and repair the tissue damage, and you're back on your feet and fit as a fiddle in no time at all. And so knowing precisely how you were injured really doesn't matter as much to the telling of the story as it would in some other games.
Well, I think one other big drawback to, you know, the damage of, you know, my arm is hurt, so it's going to be harder for me to do this or that, is when it comes to the math. I'm not a big fan of, when it comes time to attack, having to figure out a whole bunch of modifiers. I like that to be fairly consistent from round to round. So I don't want to come in and say, okay, I am fighting John now. John has a minus 2 to dodge, you know, because he's going blind.
But actually, though,
and I have a minus, but I have a minus
so
1
mad
to my
using
attack.
The barred frying pan that I'm going blind.
Exactly.
We'll minus do it. 2 modifier.
And I have a minus 3 because I'm swinging at him with a frying pan. So his minus 2 take to my 1. Oh, but he's behind cover. And as more and more of these get piled on, it gets complicated.
But let me ask you a question, Wayne, because doesn't that in a way go against what you just said, which is that you like the ebb and flow of the underdog story? Because one of the things you can see happen in a system like that is I've been stabbed in the arm, had a baseball bat strike my leg. I mean, I am just a battered man. I cannot possibly take you in a real knockout, drag down fight, but my right arm is still working. I can hide behind a knocked over table. And when you come around, I'm going to put 2 shots from a shotgun straight into your face, and that's the end of you.
I want the feel, but the problem is when you start stacking modifiers and start having to actually figure out what is my 2 hit on each round, that takes me out of combat quite a bit. Instead of thinking, okay, I'm attacking, I'm doing this, and I roll, I have to stop. It's like, okay, I'm attacking, I'm doing this, and I have a minus two to this, but I have a plus two here, and he has a minus two, and he has a plus two. Instead of that scene building in my mind, I have math formulas building in my mind to get to what I'm trying to attack with. That's one thing. I loved Battletech. As we're playing, I like it quite a bit as a, I don't even want to say as a board game, but from a tactical standpoint.
Right.
But that has always been one drawback of it, is you have to figure out every time you roll, you have to mentally do the math of what do I need to roll to hit this. I like that being a little more consistent because it helps speed things along and it keeps my mind focused on what's actually going on in the story,
right,
not the tactical side of the combat.
I think with Battletech, and this may be true actually when I think about it, in several of the tactical type games or role-playing games that have a strong tactical element, is that the story and the characters starts to emerge not in the round, but over the rounds. You start to see, oh my gosh, Wayne can't hang on to his mech. Or,
yeah.
Or, Wayne cannot hang on to his
mech. Yeah. Or you start to see that, oh my gosh.
Were you the one that blew up like three in a row?
Yes.
Yeah. I only lost one mech. Yeah,
there's the battlefield dominating locust that shows up in every combat.
Goddamn locust.
And you start to see this, the guys, my mech is falling apart. It's shattered. I'm trying to get out of here, get back to the drop ship. You guys are trying to cover my retreat. It's not a character moment that happens in a specific phase, but you kind of get this sense of it as you pull the camera back and look at the story as a whole and kind of start to create your own, I guess, meta-narrative that wraps around the tactical game.
There's a lot of advantages to it. I just think overall, feel-wise for me, I prefer, once it comes to combat time, to not have a lot of modifiers. And I know that's a game approach. Some people prefer a ton of modifiers. Some are like me and like to have as few modifiers as possible and just know going in what they need to roll.
All right, so let me ask you guys two questions. First off, placing the same boundary as our discussion on economy two episodes back, you cannot answer with it depends upon the game. If we look at the different ways of accumulating damage, generic pool of health, a pool of health with penalties that accrue along the way, stacking injuries. We can look at all these different models for describing or abstracting damage. Which would you prefer in a game? Which one feels the most natural to you?
Which one feels the most natural?
Or which one do you prefer?
I was going to say, it's better to say prefer as opposed to natural, because if I'm going for natural, it's going to be more of a, you know, obviously a more realistic model. But that's not what I prefer. I'm going to say that I prefer the hit point pool. And the reason for that is because that's what I'm so used to. I've done that for so long. So that's kind of what I am most used to playing. Now, I would like to play in a system that does a little bit of sort of the injury stacking that you're talking about, Dan, to add a little bit more realism to it, to get away from the whole point of there is no difference between a 1,000 hit point dragon and a 1 hit point dragon. There's no representation of the fact that we've cut both of his wings off. He's got three legs that are gimp and can't use his breath weapon anymore. He kicked because he still can. So you kill that one last hit point. But the one that I didn't like when you were telling of it is the one where you're talking about the modular damage. I think John, or you and Dan both sort of had that one on. That is one that I like the least. And the reason for it is this: I would abuse it, and I would not want it to be abused on me. Because when you say, okay, you take a shot to your arm and that arm is limp, it's like literally your arm's dangling.
Right.
All of a sudden, my other arm's dangling. What the am I going to do? I have no arms that I can use. I'm done. I mean, I can run around or I can headbutt.
It's just a flesh wound.
It doesn't. And it doesn't battle tech. Yes. But I'm like, I guess taking away from the guys in a big robot suit, because you can do this on a classic game where it's just regular human.
You can do the same thing to people.
I know you could. And that's for me, I'd be doing called shots to arms or called shots to legs all the time to say, okay, I'm going to hit him down because I don't want to. I'm not going to just try to shoot him in general.
Fair, in called shot systems,
it's usually harder to hit.
It is
a significant accuracy penalty. I mean, this is a real concern in real life combat. People tell you to aim center of mass, not because it isn't more effective to hit someone's, you know, first two vertebrae, but because it's hard to hit people, and you've got to aim to hit.
The difference might be that, okay, you hit somebody in the arm, might not have to do a whole lot of damage to them to disable that arm. Whereas if you hit them center mass, you know, well, maybe
I've never understood in a role-playing game,
damage, you know what I mean?
If you look at the basic physiology of a human being, your arms or legs can take a pretty good amount of damage. I mean, I realize, once again, if you cut the right arteries or the right tendons, yes, you're either killing the person or you're disabling.
When it comes down to people, everything is a chance for critical.
Right. Yes. And recognizing that fact, I get it. But the point being that if I pulled out a gun right now and said, you got to take one either in the chest or in the arm, you're going to choose the arm every time.
Yes.
But I've never understood why in role-playing games, and I've only seen a handful of do this, where they break down your damage threshold by location.
Yeah.
The torso is always the toughest location. I just don't buy it. Because you have the rib cage,
yeah,
which has all kinds of openings in it and is relatively easily fractured. And even once a rib is broken, that broken rib becomes a danger mm-hmm. to the organs that are in there. You've got the heart, the lungs, the entire abdomen is completely unprotected.
Yeah.
And you've got the descending aorta and whatever. I always thought it was insane that for some reason the torso, I mean, if I swung a baseball bat at you, what are you going to do? Your instinctive reaction is to attempt to protect the head and torso while using the mm-hmm. arms. And your arm is in some ways better set up to take that impact than your torso or your head are.
Yeah.
And I've never understood why, as a result in these games, they make the torso the toughest part of the body.
I think what they're doing there is, in considering the appendages, is they're looking at critical hits on them. Like for me, to disable an arm, that means that I'm getting shot through the bone.
Right.
Like the shot is a great one, and it goes through the large arm bone. You Radius. Know, I go through like through that, and boom, that bone is completely broken. This arm is useless
for now.
Generally speaking, though, sure it's a bullet
usually
shot.
Usually, whether like, it's a wizard or metagel, or the fact that you were made out of ferrofibrous steel, there's a way to get that thing back in pretty quick order.
Yeah,
we usually play genre games.
See, I've also taken it as more, where is the one place you're going to armor the best? It's typically either the head or the chest.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it is the chest.
Yeah.
It's easier to get a lot of armor on the chest, but there tends to be less armor on the arms because they have to have more mobility.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I've always taken it.
Okay, so Pat, your take on this is that you would prefer a hit point-ish system.
Yes.
But one that has some kind of penalty as the hit
points. Yeah, I would like to see a little bit of penalties just to add a little bit more to the realism.
So
a little bit. I'm not going for, you know, total.
Right, okay, all right, but something like what, yes. for example, Shadowrun does. Okay, Wayne, what about you?
For me, it's a kind of a combination of the two ideas. I want basically two tracks, or let's say we're talking about hit points. Let's say we have 10 hit points. I don't want zero to be death or unconsciousness. So basically, your initial hit points, I'm working through your ability to keep from getting hurt.
Okay.
Then once you hit zero, then you start getting hurt and you start taking those penalties, like you can't move as fast or maybe you don't get a full round of action.
Okay.
I don't want numbers to the rolls or anything, but I want there to be penalties to what you can and can't do at that point.
Okay, so you're talking about a stacking wound system, but one that occurs only after an initial pool's been exhausted.
Yes.
Okay.
So you have a certain amount of endurance or a certain amount of stamina, and once you've worked through that,
right.
now you're taking injuries.
Okay. No, that's fair. We had not mentioned that approach. It's a sort of hybrid approach, but that's fair enough. John?
I like the fully modular systems. I certainly don't think every time a kobold connects with you, you need to lose control of a limb or have your guts spill out, but I like the chance always being on the table. If you have mage armor, it's less likely to happen. If you have plate mail on, it's less likely to happen. Whatever. But I used back in the second edition day, whatever the ultimate combat analog was back then that had location specific criticals and all that sort of thing. And I liked it. I prefer a more piecemeal system for incapacitating and killing your foes and in having the threat of that happening to you rather than, okay, you know, this is like a buffer I have. My hit points on my fantasy fighter may as well be deflector shields because until they reach zero, I don't have much of a care in the world.
I'm with you, John. I prefer the stacking wound system. I prefer it, though, I think, for a slightly different reason, which is one, I think it does a better job of describing the deterioration of a person or a being of any kind over the course of a combat, whether we're talking about a robot or a dragon or a person. The second thing that I would say about it is I think it creates better narrative. That when you're looking at your sheet, you're like, wow, I have a nick to the arm, which was from that one sword swing. I still have a wound to the gut I'm struggling with from that bastard in the bar three games back. It creates kind of this ongoing sense of who your character is. There's a story behind that scar on the face, and it's not just there in my description block. It's something that I can tell you about how that occurred. I got that scar on the face when that one guy in that bar brawl took a shank and ran it down the side of my head and got some kind of wound to the head. Now, I will certainly agree with your point, which is that I don't think those kinds of wounds should be accrued every time you take an impact. I think sometimes it is sufficient to say, this was a flesh wound. It sucked. maybe this is kind of whittling you down overall, but we're not going to describe it in any great detail. But if somebody takes a cleaver and puts it up under your rib cage, there's something big we need to describe.
And you always care. That was one of the points that that same supplement made in second edition 20, 30 years ago, whenever it was. A D&D character will rapidly, long before he's a level 20 paragon of his class, no longer really give a crap about getting hit for 1d4 from a dagger or 1d6 from an arrow. That is not really narratively cohesive in fantasy fiction. I'm trying to think of some crazy Terry Pratchett.
How many trips to the guillotine does it take to kill like a level 20 guy?
Exception to this rule, but I have never seen a character in even the most heroic fantasy that just doesn't give a rat's when he's walking into a hail of shortbow fire from the goblins because they only are going to do 2 or 3 damage a pop.
Well, you know, one difference between a game and fiction that I've always seen, there are a lot more healers in games than I ever see in fiction.
Yeah.
Well, the healers are rare.
Well, that's something we've just addressed on the forums in a recent Pathfinder thread, is that there is a lot of overvaluing of healing capacity in games. And I think it's across more systems than just D&D Pathfinder, but people show up to these games thinking it's like, wow, where there needs to be one person of every 3 or 4 or 5 that's just there to heal hit point damage. That is not the case. You have got to put the heat on and solve the encounter before you get your panties in a wad about healing everyone back to full strength.
Well, that was
in
the traditional way that I always played D&D prior to third edition. Healing is what you do between combats. You might do it in the middle of combat if the situation is really intense, but typically speaking, the cleric was doing something else during the combat, and then healing is what you passed out after the combat was over. Yeah. You said, okay, I'm going to give Pat a cure light, Wayne 2 cure lights, John a cure moderate, and we're
going to I blame EverQuest and its progeny for that.
Right. Well, and you got to keep that tank up, man.
Exactly.
That's all that matters. It's the only thing you keep up.
No, all the DPS
can go down. Keep that tank up.
Yeah, and how you
the
approach,
tank goes down, you're all screwed.
How you approach healing has a big tie-in to how you approach your damage. In a game like, you know, Skies of Glass, for example, healing is, I'm going to put a bandage on you to stop your bleeding, so maybe you won't die. Versus in D&D, hey, your head's almost off. You're healed.
Yeah.
Also changes the sort of story you can tell because of the fact that
in a D&D game, I'm not going to care about an arrow sticking out of my chest, because
if people draw
Pat
swords,
can come over and heal me.
If people draw swords, it's a rousing challenge. In Skies of Glass, if somebody pulls out a gun, one of you is about to die or at least suffer a very serious wound. I mean, it's a little bit closer to real life in that regard. And it creates a different, and I don't think either one's better or worse, but it creates a different kind of narrative. I personally like the narratives that are a little more plausible. I like the idea that a gunshot is going to end somebody. And I recognize that you've got to be careful how you use that, because even in the types of games I prefer, I don't want them to be super lethal, because look, the faster you turn over characters, the less work you're going to put at each one of them, because you recognize that these have gone from being unique individuals to these are Pitfall Harry's many lives.
Sack it up. Make personalities for your people and then make a new one. Or if you're playing in a system where combat results in maybe you die, like, really, that's a possibility. Try not to get in fights every single game session.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying, is that's the end result. Is Johnny, you were there when we played the Skies of Glass campaign, but these guys learn pretty quickly, you don't get in a fight. Because if you get in a fight, you better freaking mean it, you know, and that's what it came down to, is they started looking for ways to either A, solve the situation without conflict, or B, make sure they had such an advantage going into the conflict. You know, they were behind cover and had their sniper shots ready and TNT about to blow up behind the bad guys. Then we're going to start shooting. Yeah. So ideally, they're not going to stand a chance, because getting shot is a big deal. It's not 1d8 points of damage that you can get rid of with Medi-Gel or a Cure Light wounds. This is a real, a bullet just went into you and is lodged up against a bone swarm. It's a big deal. Yeah,
that's a big thing. For the type of damage that you say you want in a game, John, I don't think you can have that type of healing. Because for the feel you're looking for, oh, my arm's off. If someone can just walk up and magically heal it, then it doesn't matter whether your arm's off or not.
No, it can, because of immediate tactical drawbacks.
Yeah, I agree with John, because you can put a mech up on the repair rig and put its arm back on, but that doesn't change what you did differently while it was missing the arm.
And it doesn't change how easy it now is to kill you for realsies. So.
But also in a mech, you can't have someone walk up behind the mech while he's fighting and heal and put the arm back on.
No, no,
you can't. And you can't if you're doing magical healing.
Well, there were some spinoff rules in some supplement. I don't remember how canonical this was, that did allow for really limited rapid battlefield repairs and heat exchanges, but they were super limited. It was really hard to do, and it was only mentioned like in a handful of scenarios. It was not like part of the core rules in the compendium or later in Total Warfare. Yeah,
they're so closely tied together, and to be honest, I'm not a big fan of healing in RPGs in the course of combat, because I think it tends to stretch out the combat. Yeah. You can end up in this endless loop of, I hit you for 7, your buddy heals you for 5. You hit me for 7. My buddy heals me for 5. We're wheedling it down, but it's going to take forever.
Well, or then you create the scenario of, as John said, you feel the need for the trifecta. We've got to have tank, healer, DPS. And the way you win a fight is quite formulaic. You go after the healer, and then you see how it breaks up from there, and either get rid of the DPS or the tank next. But you always start by going after the
healer.
You
typically ignore the tank for as long as you can, if you have that choice.
Yeah, because the tank's not really doing a whole lot, and it's too hard to kill. And so you do everything you can to ignore the tank, which is why in MMOs they put in the programmatic mechanic of monsters can't ignore the tank. They have to fight the tank.
And if you, walk into an arena match with a tank spec and you're not like the pants on head idiot tournament bracket level, you're going to get spanked.
This is a little bit different than going after the healer, but for me, in a typical D&D combat, one of the first targets I'm going after is that damn wizard.
Yeah.
I'm going after their high DPS, because to me, he's almost the biggest threat.
If there's a
healer, he is in D&D.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like, you've got, I may have some badass fighters I have in front, but I can deal with them after I kill that guy that's throwing lightning bolts and fireballs at me, because that's going to take me down probably faster than these guys are.
That so and crowd control.
To me, it's kind of sort of the same thing. Yeah, and crowd control.
I'm sure that everyone sitting here, and probably most of the people listening to this, have, at the very least, house ruled their combat systems a bit, maybe a lot, you know, added in supplements, taken rules out, added map combat, removed map combat, whatever. I have no doubt we've all done our own tweaks and overlays. Have you guys ever completely swapped out the combat system of a game? I have not. And I have to admit that in over 25 years of role-playing, I have never once, to the best of my recollection, dropped a game's combat system and completely replaced it with another one. I've had the temptation to, and I've played under game masters who have done this. Savaging has been the big one lately. But even prior to Savaging, I saw people that said, well, I just prefer the GURPS rule system or whatever. And they use that in place.
Wait a minute. Someone said that?
But I'm curious, is this something?
I won't know. You know, John, I think we should make a challenge for each other at Fear the Con of you pick one game that I have to run. I pick one you have to run. Oh, and God. I'm giving you GURPS.
Okay, then I refuse your challenge. Thanks. I go to Fear the Con for fun.
I actually have done that, Dan, and I've done it in a couple different ways, so I'll explain what I mean by that. The first campaign that I ran in, the long-standing campaign, we actually started in second edition D&D. Third edition came along, and 3.5 came along, so we literally switched from second to third edition first, which was minor, but it was the same campaign, a little bit of changes. But then after a while in third edition, we weren't satisfied with it. And our GM was, he had come up with his own system. He had done a complete homebrew system.
Right.
And we switched to that. So that's really the better example of what we did. It was a D20 system, but a lot of things were different. It was not just the typical D&D, you know, D20 system. So I have done that.
My question, there's a difference is, in that case, you're switching the whole system, not just the combat aspect of it. Is that what you're asking about then, the whole system or just combat?
Well,
because they're usually tied together. That's too close.
It's somewhat hard to say, because while I suppose it is possible to separate out combat and leave vestiges in place, the average role-playing game is written in such a way that, as you just said, Wayne, combat is so near and dear to the heart of the system that I think it's almost hard to do.
I can't imagine even trying to do that. I mean, replacing the whole system is one thing, because for me, I've always said the role-playing game itself and the setting are two completely different things to me. I wouldn't even see it as a big deal of taking, say, the D&D setting and adding Pathfinder as a game system for it. Wouldn't even think twice about it. But that's not even, I don't even know what I even call that.
I've generally resisted it. And the reason is, and I know I off-state, and I certainly believe that system implies setting, that the feel of the system and the tactical choices it forces you to make are going to give a certain spin to the setting. But there's actually a little bit of a different reason why I've kind of avoided doing this, which is that if you have a system that I have decided I can't fix through house rules, I need to replace this, there's probably not an off-the-shelf system that's going to do what I want. I probably can't just grab Savage Worlds Explorers Edition and make it work for a Robotech game. Unless I first go back to Savage Worlds and give it all kinds of exceptions and add-ons and rewrites so that it now does what I want. But by the time I've gone that far, I might as well just homebrewed it anyway. And so I've typically avoided doing it and said, look, if the system's just that far broken, I'll just shelve it and just find a different game that scratches that itch. I mean, that's why I don't play a lot of Palladium games. Palladium has a lot of intellectual properties that I like. I like Robotech. I certainly like Nightspawn or whatever, which eventually became Nightbane or whatever the name of that game was. God forbid I'll even say I like Rifts. I like things about the Rift setting. But the problem is that the rule system is so riddled with issues that it's easier to say, well, what is it about Rifts that's actually attracting me to the game? Isolate that itch and then find someplace else to get it scratched.
Yeah, because I mean, one thing, I know that you're very big on homebrews, and some of my favorite games have been your homebrews, but I know one thing that, like, for Pat and I both, we like having the book. If we're playing a system, we like looking through that system, seeing the rules, seeing the options, thinking about if you're doing character advancement mechanically, thinking about what am I going to do when I level, and actually like reading through the rules. And no matter how good a homebrew system is, unless you've taken the time to do that and write the rules and give it to the players, they don't have that to read between games. And not everyone's like that. Like, Chad will never sit through and read your Epoch of Risos rules if you hand it out to us.
Well, actually, even as a game master, I kind of prefer it that way because it keeps you in the character. You're not shopping for the most powerful ability. You're shopping for what makes sense. And then if you kind of say, well, wait a minute, this does not do what I expected it to do, or this is totally broken, it's too powerful, it's too weak, whatever, we can go back and adjust it. But you didn't make the choices based on mechanics. You made the choices based on story. That's one of the things I don't like about rule books. That's one of the things I don't like about books. We were talking earlier about superhero games. When you were, and I want to get this, this is a different topic. But one of the things you're talking about is that you like long lists of powers. Yeah. And I was saying I don't because of the fact that I don't want to shop them. I just want to sit down with the character concept and we'll just kind of figure out how to make it work. As opposed to saying, well, I'll take this attack and this defense and this speed boost. And it's the same sort of thing where I think to some extent, keeping somebody out of the rule book in a way keeps them more to the role-playing game. Now, I'm not saying this is some kind of dogma to me. It's not like, oh, if you look at the rule book, you've broken the game. I'm not saying that. I mean, certainly I'm happy to run D&D 3.5 or Shadowrun Battletech or any number of games that have their rule books. And if you look through and shop the powers, it's like a rule game for me.
It may sound weird to you, Dan, but for me, I get more into the universe if I can look through the rule book. Even if the rule book is just the rules, when I see the other options out there, that tells me what else is out in that world, in that universe.
Okay, I kind of feel the same way. I think what you sort of trade off there with what you're talking about, Dan, is the power balancing. And what I mean by that is, you know, you as a game master have a really good idea of what's going on. But if all that's in your head and it's not so readily available to the players, what can happen to me is that there can be an imbalance in power, because it's not that I'm looking for the most powerful combination of things, but if I'm not really sure about the system itself and read through it all, then I may not know that, oh, I not only do I need really to take this, I need to try to work on this too, just to be sort of on par with what I might come up against.
Right. Yeah, my character in the story takes the red power armor that can do this because that's all I really knew about. But my character would have had knowledge of the blue power armor that's also in the setting
that's fair.
Have picked either way. I like having a lot of options, but I have some of the same frustrations of if there's a huge long list, a lot of times it'll be just a simple, this does 5D whatever.
Yeah,
and that doesn't give me a feel of what is it like, what does it do, and I feel kind of limited because it's just an attack.
Right.
So when I say I want a full list of powers and full list of skills and things, I want that because in a lot of systems I have this idea for a character. Every little thing I need to build that character, I want it to be already there, and I put together the character I want.
Right.
Because when there are a few things, I feel it's harder for me to build that character.
I think that's going to go ahead and wrap up this conversation. Once again, don't forget to check the show notes for the Fear the Con sign up. We look forward to seeing all you guys at Fear the Con. As with previous years, I'm going to trickle out my games. So I don't know that I'm going to run a whole lot this year. I really haven't decided yet. But what games I do run, I'll certainly run at least a couple. I'm going to trickle out between now and the convention so that people that come along later or pick this up later, heck, maybe at this point don't know for sure they can make it, but we'll make that decision in a month or two or three, can still have a chance to get into something. So
I will post my first game 2 days after this episode drops.
Awesome.
So people that are early to listen to this will have a chance to go out there and see whatever game is posted first, and then the rest of them I will trickle out as well.
Okay. Well, thank you guys for tuning in. Have a great week and wonderful games as always, and we will catch you next time. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.